Welcome to episode 462 of That Triathlon Show, the podcast presented by scientifictriathlon.com. My name is Michael Eriksson, and I am sorry it's been a while since the last episode. I've been fully occupied with our two training camps that we did in 2025, first in Mallorca and then in the Algarve in Portugal. Both of these camps were fantastic experiences for me personally, and I think for all participants as well. So I want to thank everybody who took part, and I know that a lot of you will listen to this. You all made these weeks super fun and memorable, so thank you so much for that. For all the listeners, as you can imagine, while on camp, there's not much time for anything else than that, and especially with two camps in quick succession, it forced me to have a mini break from the podcast, but I'm very glad to be back again with another episode. And today I interview coach Glenn Polonis, who has been on the podcast before. He was on back in episode 335 in April of 2022, where we did more of a deep dive into his training principles. So you can listen to that episode as well if you enjoy this one. You don't have to listen to them in order though. You can start with this episode today and go back and listen to episode 335 later on, where we go into things like swim, bike and run training principles and so on. But let's thank our sponsors, Precision Fuel and Hydration. They create carbohydrate products like gels, drink mix and chews that are effective, practical and tasty. And they make electrolyte products in different strengths, so you can choose one that best matches your sweat sodium concentration. One thing that I've been asked is how to spend money efficiently on sports nutrition. And I have a few tips here. And basically, you should think about how much you spend per gram of carbohydrate when it comes to sports nutrition. Electrolytes, that is, of course, a little bit different. But in terms of the carbohydrate, you can do an easy analysis and how to get that cost down, the number of euros or dollars per gram of carbohydrate down, is to A, buy in bulk, because you save a lot this way. And this is specifically to Precision Fuel Hydration, at least. I can't speak for other brands, of course. B, with Precision Fuel Hydration, some of their products, like the 90 gram gels, the Flow Gel, and especially the drink mix, they have the lowest cost per gram of carbohydrates of all of their product lines. So go for those options especially. And C, of course, as you know, you can get 15% off your first order of 2025 by using the code TTS25 on precisionfuelhydration.com. There's no getting around the fact that sports nutrition does cost money, unfortunately, like everything. But you can be smart about how you spend money. I'm a super conscious spender myself in almost anything. So I wanted to share my analysis with you that I've done here and give an extra shout out to the drink mix, which is the cheapest option of all, and the PF90 gels, because they are very affordable, but are also very high quality options to go for from the Precision Fuel and Hydration range. Now, without any further ado, let's get into the interview with Coach Glenn Polonis. Welcome back to That Triathlon, Glenn. How are you doing?
I'm good, thank you. I just arrived in Sierra Nevada, and I think last time we also had our call from Sierra Nevada, so it's getting a bit of a flashback to that period. So when we just started here with a group coming in Sierra Nevada, and it's good to catch up with you again.
Yeah, definitely. I think I had it somewhere in my questions. I believe 3 years ago that we spoke. Was it that long, or 2 years ago?
I think so, yeah. Time goes by so fast, it's insane. It's like yesterday, but... So
with that in mind, lots of new listeners that probably haven't heard of you, can you give us a bit of a reintroduction to who you are?
Well, I hope it's the same as what I said last time. So I don't remember what I said, but I'm from Belgium, from the Flemish parts. I was actually always super interested in sports. I played soccer very fanatically. I was obsessed by a ball, but then at one point I got a little injury. I had some relatives who were in cycling, and I got obsessed with cycling more and more. So I became quite a good cyclist. I was doing my first steps with the professionals. Had a good team, learned a lot by having bad teams, good teams, coaches in that period. But then I had to stop with an injury. I had a kiss at tuberculum. I had some operations, and my world just collapsed, of course, immediately, because you have one thing, big thing. It was eye-opening. I did some traveling, and I decided at one point, okay, I want to go back into sports. How am I going to do that? I was interested in physiotherapy, so I studied at the KU Leuven in Belgium, physiotherapy. But while doing that, I also discovered triathlon in the first place, and also that I was more interested even in exercise physiology. So I started doing courses with the sports department and doing more exercise physiology while finishing my degree as a physio, which I think now as a coach is really beneficial to have both from the biomechanical side and the physiology side. I had some great professors there like Peter Hespel. And I think I was always a natural coach. I was always trying to, I remember from soccer that I was sometimes like trying to organize a defense all the time. And I was, when I was cycling, my first coach, I remember I had to go with this little book every week on my easy rides to my coach and explain things. And I was asking him questions all the time. So I think it's a bit natural and it doesn't feel like work, which is always dangerous as well, I think, because you're always working. So no, I think that's a bit of my story, and I developed a squad in triathlon over the years, which has been going good, and I guess that's why we're here now in the talk as well.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Let's talk about the squad a bit. So you're based in Girona. It's the PTC coaching, or do you call it the PTC squad? Can you talk more about the squad?
Well, we don't often call it PTC ourselves. You know, we're just like a group of people who train together in Girona. I came from Belgium, where I worked for the Belgian Federation, especially with under 23 development athletes. And I saw them going to the highest level and I felt there's something lacking, you know, like a high performance culture and good circumstances to train people who go all in. And if like, yeah, they don't have... it's okay if they study or whatever, but just that feeling of like we're taking a risk to get to the highest level. And I feel like that's what we have in Girona, like people from all countries joined the group over the years. And I have some amazing athletes now in the group. So I think we have a bit of everything. And it's like the circuit is like developing, like people are combining short distance with middle distance, long distance. So that makes it very interesting and challenging as well at the same time. Especially also with how I see the like athlete development and individual coaching versus group culture. I want to make most of both. So I try to individualize as much as possible. And yeah, I think that Girona is a very good place, as you know, to train. So except for the past few weeks where there was a lot of rain. But no, in general, that's a bit, yeah, the story, how we developed the squad over the years. And I'm very happy where we're at now at the moment. So.
Yeah, for the listeners that might be interested, who are some of the more well-known athletes that you have in the squad?
Martin van Riel is maybe one of the most famous guys who won the T100 last year, who just stepped up to the longer distance. We have some guys who went to Olympics, like Charles Paquette, Alessio Crociani. We have Ewan De Negro, it's a young guy from Italy who is European champ on the super sprint. We have Arnaud Delis. A good athlete who's European champ as well, who's also qualified for European championships running recently. Yeah, now we also have Cassandre Beaugrand, the Olympic champ, who joined the squad after the Olympics. And I'm missing a few, of course. I have to look at my list of athletes, so I don't want to feel anybody left out. No, I think it's in general like a good mixture of some young people with experience, and they stimulate each other all the time. In yeah, keeping it playful, but also the experience the older ones have to have that good mixture of balance of fun, but also like very science driven training and like looking for details. It's really nice environment.
Yeah, looking at your website, I think it's about a bit more than 10 athletes, 10 to 15 athletes.
I have to say the website is really not up to date, so I haven't been there on myself, I think, for 2 years, so. I think now I have 14 athletes, which is quite demanding, to be honest. And most of them are in Girona. I have some people who sometimes come more for camps to Girona and join them. And it's a bit more like on, working remote. So, but in general, I see most of the athletes regularly, and we can make also the best out of training together.
And how many athletes are with you now in Sierra Nevada for the camp?
In Sierra Nevada, we had to split up the group, so we only have 5 athletes. This is one of the challenges that I said. Like we have different programs, and it has to fit the program. And it's more like the people who are racing end of May, and also the people who have enough experience with altitude, because some people are a bit afraid of the altitude as well in Sierra Nevada. And I think it's always listening to the athlete as well. Like, what is this? I have some athletes who could have been here, I think. But maybe there were some personal circumstances which made it like more interesting to not do it at this time. So the group is split up and I have somebody helping me in Girona. It's Vanessa De La Torre. It's like an ex-athlete, professional athlete as well, who's got a degree in sports nutrition, who's normally my sports nutritionist, but her contact with the athletes is really good and she understands the training, what we have to do, and she's very good in the field with helping the athletes. She knows, she was my athlete as well, so she knows every little detail and I can feel confident of leaving the athletes there behind. And it's only for a few weeks and I go back to Girona and pick up there again. So yeah, it's a bit of, that's the difficult part, I think. We can't be always at the same place everywhere according to the calendars, especially if World Triathlon keeps on changing the calendars very last minute. It makes it even more challenging. But yeah, I think we make the best of it. And I'm like I say, I'm in contact with the people there like almost every day. So it goes quite well. And I feel I'm maybe even more useful here on this altitude camp, like to make sure in the first period people don't do crazy things, and just also monitor the athletes by seeing them. It's a bit more tricky on this altitude. I think that's also the main reason why I'm in Sierra Nevada, for example, now.
Yeah, it makes sense. Mm-hmm. So when we chatted 3 years ago, or about 3 years ago, we talked a lot about your coaching philosophy and also the mm-hmm. philosophy behind the squad itself and building a good culture in the squad. If you talk about those two topics, are there anything that has evolved in either of those in the last few years, roughly since we spoke, or even changed completely?
Yeah, of course, my knowledge always grows as well, I think. And like in 3 years, I always want to learn. And something I always tell my athletes as well, I'm not saying that this is the best thing we are doing. I just try to get as much data as possible to think that this is the best thing that we're doing. And at some point, it's also trial and error, I think. We try to create as much as possible certainty that there's no much error, I think. So, but in general, it's still the same approach. And I saw your question. I was thinking, like, I still work in quite a similar way, which is a good thing. And I like, there's some details that definitely changed in, like, how to individually tailor training as well. But it's quite holistic. So I want to really also know what's going on in the world of the athlete, not only on training wise, and be close to them. I think it's very important that people also understand the philosophy. It's quite important to me, and it can create a lot of conflict if people like also in the group, you know, if we see somebody is pushing when it's not necessary. I think it's some kind of culture we created that everybody knows what they have to do, and we monitor a lot on training, like intensity and by doing lactate, heart rate, other stuff. So I think we collect that data and the athletes get this insight as well of, okay, this is what's happening to my body and changing. And I'm quite proud of that like that they are also developing together with me in this. And I don't think they need to overthink. So I have to give them information. And at one point, I just have to let go and trust the process. And at regular points, we evaluate and have talks. And then, okay, we go to the next training block and we believe this is the best approach and we go for it. So I think
I was going to come back to a point you said there about you want to know what's going on in the athlete's world. I understand it as outside of the training itself. How do you make that happen? Because with some athletes, it's probably very natural. The athlete just naturally shares things and talks about things, but with others, and this might also maybe have something to do with which culture or country they come from. Things are maybe a bit different in different cultures. How do you make it happen with athletes that maybe are not naturally inclined to talk about what's going on outside of training, and but things that might still evolve or affect their performance?
Well, I think it's a very good point you make. I see a lot of cultural differences with working with people from different countries, and some people are super open and immediately come to me. And other people, that's why I say it's still important to see the athlete, I think, and because they don't do this, and something you can't see from data or self-reported mood or whatever. It's always different, I think. And I think it's one of my skills as well, that I can feel it a bit, and like just by how they enter the room or go, and then just find the right time to just say, hey, I see this and this, what's going on, you know? And like just, I think that some of them think, oh no, he's there again, you know? Sometimes they don't want to hide. They want to hide it a bit, and like, and oh fuck, I have to talk. I have to talk again about this, and or something we worked on, and it's not going in the right direction. I just think it's just a important factor in recovery, and like getting into flow, which is really important, I think, that I want to get these things off the table. And sometimes it's a process. And I also have in the talk with the athlete, like say, okay, we give you the time, you know, like it's not, if it's a serious issue, we need to solve this over time. I don't care about the performance. If it goes down a bit in the long term, it can make you better, but we have to work on it, you know? And I think authenticity is very important. And I want to be able to tell the truth. That's has always been important to me. It doesn't matter if you're a world champ or just an under 23 developing athlete. I feel like sometimes with the best athletes, they're surrounded with people who always say yes and want to be part of their environment, you know? And if I feel I can't do that anymore, I feel like I'm losing in a way. And because I think we can still improve in many things. And this is definitely one of the things that if athletes could come more quickly even with these things to me and recognize it more, I think that's more the best way of saying it, that they should recognize their problems more quickly. And then we can do something before it's too late. I think that would be a huge step if that open-mindedness for their eagerness to learn about training would also be the same on like the eagerness of getting to know their mind and their limiting factors on the psychological part. I think if we can establish that, we will have another advantage, I think. So.
Yeah. And the other follow-up I wanted to make was when you mentioned that there are some things that you do differently in terms of the individualization of the program. Do you have some examples that come to mind of what that might be?
Yes, I think we do a lot of, like I said, lactate testing. I collected all those data. I work a lot with Insight as well, the program to evaluate to see if the training is going what I think it should be going to. And I think like this is maybe the, I always did that, but it was a bit more of like getting to know, like getting insights. And now it's more like we know what we are doing, like we have a clear plan of what we're doing, and we try to reevaluate it more often. I think that's the main thing that changed. And we, like, I always feel hesitant as well to these new tools that I have introduced a lot of them, actually, to be honest. And for me, it's like the burden on triathletes is so big of like trying to find a way of reporting data, making sure everything is up to date and make sure they have enough rest. And I feel sometimes I'm like bothering them with this. And this is something that it's a very tricky balance to, like, for example, time for collecting breeding data. We have Calibre, we have so many other heat data. And it's sometimes I show up to a session and it's like, is it working? And like, it's not. And like, that sometimes gets a lot of frustrations. And I think these tools are very useful, and I have to think, when do I use it and which times to individualize the process. And if I think, for example, there's something wrong with your breeding, I would tell, okay, I think this is for you the best thing, and not put all tools on every person, you know. I think that's how I changed it, instead of trying to say, hey guys, this is now something state of the art and we should use this all. Maybe in the past I wanted to like maybe impose that a bit on the athlete, and now it's more like, I think this could work, how do you see that, where we're going to try to find the next percent. And I think it can only work, like I said, if the balance is there on the life stress and the workload on the training side.
Yeah, and I guess it also takes a lot of time to, or some time at least, to actually benefit from using those sorts of tools, because when you first start measuring something, you can measure it, but even if it's accurate, you don't know if it's good or bad. Imagine you're one of the first persons that start doing aerodynamic testing, and you can figure out that, okay, my CDA is 0.20, but what does it mean? You don't really know if it's good or bad. But then when more people are measuring, you might have a squad of people measuring, then you can start to compare and see what's good and what's bad. And it's the same thing with a lot of those sort of things that you can measure, that you have to collect, you have to get experience with getting that data to see what it actually means and how you can use it. When you mentioned that,
I was also like, I think I work with some outliers, you know, like with these high level athletes, and like the data you see in the literature is sometimes not what you expect, and then it's also like you see this, you discover these things along the way, and like, it's also sometimes, oh, I didn't expect this, you know, like, and then you have to start rethinking, and why is this and that and that. I think that's also something, like, sometimes you don't have the immediate answer to that when you see some certain data coming, and like, and then you have to then I consult maybe an expert that I know about this topic, and then I go back to the athlete. And like, I think that's now the culture as well, that we know that, huh? Like, and that's a super interesting part of working with these outliers. I think they're physiological freaks in a way. And yeah, I think that's an interesting journey in general. I hope that one day I can also use all that data to also like to help people if they work with this kind of athletes as well, to see like not everything in a textbook. Like, some things I would never do with athletes if I didn't have the experience and trust now to do that, like volume wise or intensity wise or recovery like periods. Like, I see there's so much individual difference, and when you collect the data you got more proof of what's happening, you know, and you can do that educated guess better.
So can you give some examples of the where some of the athletes might be outliers compared to the textbook or the literature? What are you talking about there?
Yes, I see, for example, one big thing is like lactate values, huh? Like I see some, like I have people with anaerobic threshold LT2 or max less, about 2.2 minimal. Like, and it's something like if you don't know that and collect the data regularly, like that you would say that you're not pushing enough, or for example, and we try to also see then if the anaerobic system is strong enough combined with that, you know, and like find that balance between VO2 max and VLA max is a very important principle what we work with, especially with the different distances that we're doing, and to evaluate that. That's something that you see like not much reported in literature, I think. Also like the recovery periods, like how that's so individual with the people, of course, with the high VO2 max. Like, I think that's something, like, for example, in the swim, collecting a lot of heart rate data, like, that's where I can tailor the swim and lactate combined with that to see, like, okay, we're going to make your recovery periods way shorter than like what we should normally do. I mean, and that's something like these little things that can make a really big difference in the end, I think. But it takes time to look at all these data all the time, and like, but now I feel like the athletes, they know this, and they start to feel the benefit of it, and they're very interested in this as well. So,
yeah, that's great. And coming back to one of the things you said there about collecting breathing data, what kind of breathing data is that? Is that spirometry, or is it continuous ventilation during exercise, or what are we talking about there?
Yeah, it's more looking at breathing frequency and tidal volume of the athletes. It can also be very like a good indicator of when your W prime is, for example, getting exhausted, to see if you do an extra set or not, or see if there's a like a discrepancy with breathing frequency at lower intensities, to look at like should the breathing pattern be different or not. I think the technology is getting there, like at this point, and it could be very useful for athletes. But in like when I started working with it, there was still some bugs for user friendliness, I think, and that's what I say, like, we're not in a lab, you know, we're not like using this, everything is ready, it's on the field, everything, which is also very important to me, that it's in the field working well, because we're training in the field all the time, we're racing in the field. Also with the lactate test, I just made these little protocols that I think work well, that simulate the field conditions as much as possible. So I think that's, yeah, like a very interesting domain as well, the breeding, but not easy to collect that data on top of all the other data that we have.
Yeah. And what about the, in terms of the squad and the culture, how squad cohesion and anything that you do to build that and develop that to facilitate the performances, is there anything that you've done there in the last few years to improve that?
Well, I think we try to have a regular talk. That's already a big thing. And in the past, this was easier, you know, like the calendars were always very clear. End of October, everybody was finished and we could do something like a weekend. We went somewhere in the mountain or whatever, like to do some mountain biking and have some talks and have some beers as well, like to have this off table, like topics about life and whatever, and grow closer to each other. But now with people racing in December, it's a struggle to get everybody at the same time, you know, at the same moment. And I just want to, at sessions when we are there together, sometimes we have this little talk about, hey guys, what do we see? Or when somebody is struggling, we had like an issue in the group past winter, which wasn't easy, to be honest, for me, like it was something completely between persons. And then I always go back to what are the ethical values, you know, and why do we take a decision? I had to make a hard decision at that point. And for me, these are the key principles. And if you start cheating on those, I think you lose your credibility with your athlete on the long term as well. And it can be that this person is close to another person, whatever. You have to make sometimes that, like, don't cheat on that, I think. And that's super important. And then you can, I hope the athletes learn from that as well, for making life decisions in their future. So, and yeah, that you're always able to look in the mirror of why you do what, you know?
Yeah. If we look back a bit on the Paris Olympics and the Olympic cycle, the qualification period leading up to it, what comes to mind for you? What are the things that went well? Is there anything that didn't go well? What are the learnings that you took from that, from the Olympics themselves, but also the qualification period leading up to it?
Well, I think there were things that went good and went bad. And I think also with World Triathlon and the organizing committee, especially, it was a really stressful period, to be honest, with around the water quality in Paris. And I think they should have been handled way better, of course. And some athletes respond better to this and not. I try to prepare my athletes as good as possible for the unpredictability of these things. But I think, like, having a plan B, and then you having to wake up on the morning of the race to see if you're gonna be able to race at 4:30, and then not go into your plan B, but make a quick plan C, like, just to be able to race in the sand in Paris. I think that was just, like, ridiculous. And we felt a bit like puppets in a show that were had to perform just in front of the beautiful building in Paris, and which is understandable, but you work so hard for something, and you feel like some athletes were really stressed about this. And yeah, or there was even talks about having a duathlon, you know, and it should not be happening on the biggest stage of your sports where athletes worked so long for. I think this is not in our control, so we have to work with it. I think in general, our preparation went really good. The most important thing that I learned, I knew it as well, I think, is that the qualification early is, like, really important to have, like, a smooth process without stress, I think, to go into the Olympics. And that was a difficulty, I think, within the squad, which, for example, Martin, he had his injury, like, after the Leeds crash, a long time out, really long time. So when he was coming back finally and getting regular training, he had another horror crash with breaking his ribs and scapula, so that he almost didn't get any results. So we had to, like, race Yokohama and Cagliari for securing the qualification. Then I think what I learned from that period was, like, a healthy mental athlete is super important. And for Martin, something like going to T100 and middle distance, because he was feeling like, I'm missing out on this, you know, like, and I feel this is even better playing into my strengths. And we knew that. So we had to make a plan to have one result in T100 before Olympics as well. So that wasn't easy. And then that's a hard talks with the federations, because then don't know these athletes, you know, like, and it was also a new culture in the federation at that time, who didn't know Martin from, I think, a long time. I was 100% sure he could combine this, you know, like, and also feel, like, super relaxed of doing this. And it was super pleasant to work with him in that period, because he was so motivated, and his recovery is his biggest strength, I think. And I think that was something that created stress within federations and athletes not doing the program that they wanted. And some of it is, like, because of circumstances, because you can't, we couldn't qualify earlier, otherwise it was way easier. But yeah, that's why I think that early qualification is super important. I saw the same with Charles Paquette. It was, like, an amazing journey to get to the Olympics. He really stepped up, like, in those races. But it also was, like, already we had to qualify in May, and then, like, not much rest, go back to the next camp and go there again. And then it was also, like, in a different category of almost not going to Olympics to being able to go for top 10, you know. So that was something new. And the same with the Italian guy, who under 23 guy still, who was showing very good prospects and was very last minute that we knew if we could go or not. I think that's the key finding of trying to secure that qualification as early as possible to make a very good plan without stressors, I think. And then maybe the mistake that I make, and I know you know what my favorite book is Anti-Fragile, you know, being prepared for everything. And with that change in scenario, it happened that we have to race from, what was it, 8 in the morning towards 11 in the heat in Paris. And I think that's the only factor that I feel as a coach that I should have prepared better. Still, it was hard because we went to Font-Romeu and then we went back to to Girona the last 2 weeks for the Olympics. We had some heat, of course, but if I look back at it now, like the run, I was standing there on the Champs-Élysées in the sun without some protection, without anything. I was thinking, oh, fuck, it's like really getting hot here. I mean, like, this wasn't the normal circumstances, but we should have integrated, I think, some more heat. And so that was something that I think that I look back on that was, lacking.
Yeah, well, I think lots of athletes and coaches look back at that in the same way. With hindsight, it's easy to say that it should have done a bit more heat prep, but a lot. I don't think that many people actually did that. So
well, I know people did it. Sometimes we also integrate heat as part of the normal process, you know. But I felt, with that late qualification, we need a little break after those two Olympic distances. Like, it's a choice you have to make. Like, okay, I'm going to go throw on top heat and this and then go to altitude. You know, like, the balance is very tight at that time, I think. And you need to get the volume in again and the training load. And looking back, I think, like, we should have made that call of maybe training a little bit less volume and trying to integrate heat more in that period, combining with altitude. So I think that's, yeah. Like I say, that's something that we should have maybe done better.
Yeah. With the early qualification question, there are some differences in the qualification procedures between different federations that makes it a bit, even though to some extent it tends to be the same races, the test event, the grand final the year before, where you have to perform, but how you have to perform varies depending on the federation. And then, of course, the competition within the different federations is very different. So even things like being selected for races and having enough points to be selected, that is something that can vary a lot from athlete to athlete. But is that something that you're now thinking about going into LA, that already what do each athlete need to do to set themselves up to, if possible, get an as early qualification as possible or be ready to perform in those early key races where federations tend to have their key markers for automatic qualification, or at least put a high emphasis on those races in the selection process?
Yeah, I think that's one of the I think there's two things, looking at this, what will be the demand to, and it's like you say, very different for each federation, and these criteria are also not known yet for the next Olympics. So we have to wait a bit for that. And then I think also, what do I see as a limiting factor of the athlete of getting this medal or whatever, what we want to go for with this athlete? Like, combining those two, see somebody is like very good on the shorter distance, needs to get better on Olympic distance. How do we tailor the training and then peaking at that time where we can do the early qualification, I think. And also try out the setup, how are we going to approach LA, altitude, heat, like where are we going to do that? Try that out on those key moments as well. Does it work or not? Like, to learn from that, something can always go wrong in life, you know that as well. But I think, that's just really one of the main findings. I think if we can approach that qualification period or that event where we have to perform, really like Olympics, I think that's really important with that mindset. And then, it's super, relaxed, I think, to work towards that Olympics, and you have way more flexibility in your decision making in the end.
Yeah. How do you think that the LA cycle will look like compared to the Paris cycle in terms of things like the demands of the competition? Are there certain things that will be more or less important in the LA cycle than they were, or any other changes that you foresee coming up?
In general, I think the level is extremely high at the moment, so I don't think there will be a huge leap in performance. I think it will be more the details, like the little things, like that will become more important. And it's like the material you'll be using, the suits, you know, like aero, the skills you got on the bike level is in general something that has increased a lot, I think, especially in the width of the field. With the men it was already, and also now with the women that's coming. So I think with the women, the bike part will be even more crucial in the next period. I don't think there will be a huge leap in performance in running speed. I think it's to be able to do that after the hard bike. That will be very important. And like the little things like transitions, make sure you don't. And that's why I think sometimes, like, I feel like people with an excess of talent, sometimes they take this a bit too like flexible, and like you need to execute every little thing because the level is so close to each other, I think, now that you just need to have that little bit more left in the tank at the end of the race, and that will be super important to execute everything perfectly or as close as perfect. And I think if I look at the men, I see this young generation coming up, like with very aggressive racing, super fast swimmers. So I think it's up to the people who are like to make sure to realize this in time to stay on top of the swim as well. Like it is really like it's high power in the front of the men's race, I think, now. And in the end, we had people who could bridge up that. But if the power is getting close in the front to the power in the back, I think it will be interesting to see what will happen there, I think.
Yeah.
I think to like have this healthy climate, I think, you know, like there's more and more pressure on the athletes. We see it in cycling, like to keep it like still very light and put it in perspective. I think that will also be very important to keep it lightweight. I sometimes use this term, like with this famous fitness guy who's and I think I saw a good example of driving to Sierra Nevada. I had to think about this. Like my dog, I got in from the shelter. It's like a super, super example. But he's always stressed when we are moving and we are packing stuff. And like, and the day we were leaving in the morning, like she did her number two everywhere in the living room. And like, just because of stress, and it was like just a reminder of myself, like, okay, this is how much like psychology affects your body, you know? And I think that's again, that early qualification that I said as well, like if you can do that early, and also realize your stressors and be open about it so you can go super. I think sometimes there is so much stress in this, like in this high performance thing, which shouldn't be there, and it could be way easier. And I think if you can find the right tools to get the athletes like in the right mind space before that, and like I think it's a huge benefit as well. Like, so I think that will be a key thing towards what I want to focus on towards LA as well.
Yeah. With the bike skills that you mentioned, is that something that you integrate a lot in the training, doing things like crit training and things like that?
Yes, absolutely. Like I think it also depends on which athlete. Of course, some people need it more and more. And I also work now with a guy in Girona, an ex-pro cyclist, and I go with him because I can't follow anymore on the bike. I don't have time to train. And we do like these little circuits, U-turns, sometimes a bit more on speed, you know, like sometimes a bit more low speed, and trying to increase that speed all the time. I think it's, you have to practice this, you know. And I have to, like talking about Cassandra earlier, I think I remember in Font-Romeu, like her sometimes on the parking lot doing this a lot of well. I think these are things the athletes sometimes really don't like, but like it's so crucial, I think, to save as much watts as you can by being efficient on the bike and positioning and the skills. So it's again about having that energy in the tank at the end, and to be confident on your bike as well. It creates, again, relaxation to race with a free mind.
Yeah. Mm. Let's talk a little bit about T100 and Martin's success there. I guess the first question that I have is more about how do the demands of the T100 differ from the demands of WTCS? Are they very similar because obviously he stepped up really well, or are they quite different and it's just a very suitable format for him? And then maybe we can go into a bit of what that means for in terms of training differences for T100 compared to WTCS.
Well, I think first of all, it's not that different. We can see people making transition quite easy from WTCS, but I see the demand is more like on the bike parts, like the change to the T-bike position, and like also saving energy again. That's why I say like we evaluate a lot with on the testing on the bike, for example, seeing where his anaerobic system is towards his aerobic system. That's something we had to like focus on with key sessions to make sure he's ending that bike with a lot of glycogen in the tank to start a run. I think that was one of the things that we emphasized, and we had to. Like, I was very surprised actually in San Francisco. Not surprised because I knew he would do it physiologically, he was quite ready for it. But like, he was almost never on a TT bike before that race, you know, and like after doing two Olympic distances for qualification for, and then just go there and just win the race, I think he was definitely not as prepared as he should have been. It was quite impressive still for me, I think. And I think that also shows that the training of WCS towards T100 is not that different if you're a strong biker. And I know for Martin, it's hard for him to show his strong bike. We all know it from people like Hayden Wild or Christian, because they're not in the front of the race in the beginning and they come up. Yeah? But for Martin, if he's on the front with his good swim and he's pushing on the bike there and people making benefit of him all the time, it doesn't make sense, you know, and he doesn't, people know he's a strong biker, but maybe he didn't show that much in the races because he had to qualify and race also like a bit tactically more. I think, so I knew he would be able to step up quite easy. I think for him, the swim is something that is like, we can see it's quite easy for him now on the T100 series. So I don't want him to get too lazy in it, because sometimes he thinks he can swim less and less because it's not his favorite. But I want to keep him sharp in that, but like by keeping the quality in the swim and not doing too many swim sessions, and make sure he's still energy efficient as well. So, yeah.
Yeah.
And I think we had to do a lot of strength work, like on the bike. I think that was one thing to, like I say, to finish that bike part strong was quite important.
Right, right. What about the run training? Has that been different now that he's focused more on the T100, doing more longer runs with race pace work or things like that?
Yeah, especially in the last period. I think Martin responds well to doing a lot of like LT2 max last work. I think so. We That's not that different, but in the last period of going to more race specific, we did longer tempos, also running up the bike after a long TT effort to get used to that, I think, on race pace. And like, I think that's also like, we could run faster, I think, if he bikes easier even, like, but I think, you know, like with guys like Laidlaw and Ditlev, the pace will be on and like, you need to be able to match that. And then we also knew if we could run this pace efficient afterwards, also again from the testing, we could see that he could hold that for a very long time, sustainable, even if he's quite dead after the bike. So I was quite secure if he wasn't in that margin that he would still be one of the fastest runners in T100. And I think he showed that that it's still there. And I think we have to do a bit less of that VO2 work, I think, or race specific at like 10K, 5K pace in the end. And that is more shifted to more longer tempos in the end period. And now, of course, with stepping up to Ironman, it's still a different world as well.
Yeah, well, that's the follow-up. Then what about the difference in training for Ironman and the difference in race demands for Ironman?
Yeah, I think there we have to really see that, like, we knew VLMX was going down, for example, and we wanted to evaluate that. And I think Martin responds very well to high volume, and like, there are different ways of getting that anaerob system down. And it was like, also including nutritional strategies, like sometimes doing some, like especially some hard workouts, and then the day after a bit depleted, like with not overfueling with carbs. I think that's something that we tried, and it's very tricky because if your energy demand is super important, then we want to be fresh again by the next session when there's intensity again. So I think there is, the shift was more to doing a lot of torque training to get those fast twitch fibers more aerobic, combine that in sessions with more volume in the run, especially, I think. Not more volume in general in a week, but longer sessions. And I think a bit less swim again, even that's what makes him very happy about the Ironman training. So I think, it was still quite different. I think the T100 and WCS are closer to each other than, of course, going to full Ironman. And I think we had a very good block towards South Africa now, and many things went wrong there in the end, I think. So he couldn't show his full potential, but I was really, really happy with seeing, enjoying the training and seeing him respond to the training that we did. That was very good for the confidence, I think. And it was, as we know, not an easy combo during the T100 in Singapore the week after. I think I would never make that choice with one other athlete that I've ever coached to do that. I told you, like, his recovery is quite insane. And like, I think we wanted one result before, so we could, if it worked out, that we can work freely towards Nice. And that was the only reason we did it. And there was no many other options in the calendar to do that, I think. So I think there, like, it was better than expected, if I'm honest, yeah, like to do that the week afterwards. But I think it was a bit of a guess, but it worked out very well. And now he had some time to recover and we're back on altitude now. So he can do the T100 in San Francisco and in Vancouver. And then it's just, if nothing goes wrong, of course, we don't have to do any other races and just focus completely on this, where I'm very curious to see him on that course competing with, yeah, the strongest one on the Ironman. So
yeah, that'll definitely be very exciting to see. About the Ironman training, do you still keep it? You said that he responds well to that LT2 or maximum lactate steady state work. Do you still keep that in and also do some Ironman specific work, or do you focus a lot on the specificity in the final weeks before the race, or what is the, let's say, intensity distribution of the key sessions?
Well, I think we started with doing a lot of easy volume, like after the race period, with some, maybe included like a lot of like LT1 or FatMax, whatever you want to call it. And like I said, we monitor those sessions as well a lot, like to make sure it's really coming from the fat metabolism as much as possible and keeping the lactate low in those sessions. So we started with that, and then we like I said, we did some LT2 work, and then in the end part we did like long sessions around Ironman pace. We try to keep that threshold very close, and I think with an athlete like Martin, you like work on VO2 max a lot on the long term, like with the volume that he does, which he responds very good to, and like the stroke volume is also very important, I think. And with that volume that he is doing, it's one of the best things if you keep it controlled to keep that VO2 max high on the long term without having to do VO2 short term sessions. I think it would take a lot of energy for him. So I think that's how we want to do it, and then get that threshold as close as possible still to that VO2 max and make him as efficient in the last period around Ironman pace power. I think that was a bit of the plan that we had towards this block.
And the volume that he's doing, roughly how many hours a week is it, and how does it distribute across swim, bike, and run?
Well, I think so most of the time, like around 30 hours, and it's also like how you monitor things. I think that's very like the swim. Some people say 2 hour swim, but it's like 1 hour 15. Like I think gym as well. Like we don't monitor, that, but I don't. We make not too big. So 30 hours doesn't seem so big, but it's like really 30 hours of work, I think. And we combine some heat as well with that, for example. It's also a stressor on the body. We also have to take it into account. We don't do like these killer weeks of 35 often, you know, like, but it's like many weeks of 30, like, and he's like really responding to that very well, I think. We don't have to do these big off weeks in between. So, and volume wise on the bike, I think he's like most of the time around 15 to 17 hours, and they run around 100K. And it can be weeks of 120 and weeks of 80Ks around that. And the swim is like 4 or 5 times a week now. Like in the specific period, we go more to four swims now, I think, to get a bit more recovery. And his swim is really not going down. Like, it's also good for me to see, like, because I was also a bit scared, like, is his swim going down when he swims less? But at the moment, that's not the case. And I think he wants to show that to me as well, in a way, that his swim is not going down. So that makes him more motivated for the swim, which is a good thing. So I think, yeah, it's a bit of the volume he's doing.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's really, really interesting. And one final follow-up on this. You mentioned the torque work that you've been doing on the bike. What does the torque work look like for you? Because that's something that I think in cycling and triathlon is, there are different ways of doing it. And I think the trend seems to be in cycling, at least, to be going towards more intensity there and a bit shorter intervals. But how do you do it?
Actually, I do a bit of a combination of both. Like, let's say that I do it often towards the end of a session. Like, let's say we do a big LT1 session, and then I can end with some high intensity torque short fractions at the end of the session. And when we go more to race specific periods, we do a bit more like medium intensity with 60 cadence, for example, but like for 3 times 20 minutes, for example, you know, like, and to really, and again, maybe in a bit of that depleted state where we want to do that to make those fast twitch muscles who need some kind of threshold of like of force development before they're activated. And I think that's when we try to make them as aerobic as possible. And it also makes them strong towards that end part of the bike, I think. So it's a bit of a combination of both, I think. And that's, again, maybe the science versus the field, I think. So I try to always think, what do we need at what time? And even if this is not really in the literature described, I think it works very well for me with this athlete. And I believe in that, and I go for that. I think that's a bit of a, the way we work with the torque.
So you mentioned earlier that the season calendar, the racing calendar, makes things complicated to get together at the end of the season. I'm sure it also makes it complicated to just plan the season in general, especially when athletes are doing multiple, following multiple goals or series like WTCS plus Super Dry or WTCS plus T100 or whatever it might be, T100 plus Nice, Ironman. So can you discuss a little bit how you think about the racing calendar and how you periodize the training of your athletes with the way that the seasons typically look like now, with long periods between the first and the last race of the season and quite a lot of races?
Yeah, I think you always start from what are your A races, of course, and you look how can you still perform in those the best. Like, for example, now as well, I think in the T100, the grand final will still be very important. So that's how you design your calendar, you know, like you see like, okay, Ironman is September, and the grand final is half December. So I think having those regular breaks in the season is super important, you know. And I think if you start skipping those at the moment, with both on the mental side for the athlete to have this off period and the physical side, we often do like this 1 week. I often know like two or three times in the year where you have like this week, maybe even without a schedule. Or they have a bit of, try to do three runs in this week, and you do like one time bike and two time swim, depends from athlete to athlete, or you go hiking, whatever makes you happy. I think this is becoming more and more important with the race calendars as they are developing now. And like, you don't have to worry about your training load in those moments, I think, because if you see your athletes fresh again on the training, like 10 days later, that's most important thing, and you feel you can energized going back into that next training block. That's the most important thing, and I prefer them being a bit less fit coming back and but super motivated. And I think if you start skipping that, it's a tricky line. And combining different races, like for example, like you said, Super Tri with WCS, I think your athlete has to be ready for that. Like, and that's also where your steady volume that you're doing, how many years of training, otherwise can also like quickly deteriorate, I think. So what I try to do then is like in the less important races, I just train like normal volume almost in between, and just see the races as good in their development and have fun, and as key specific sessions, and because you have to pick your battles, of course. Mm-hmm.
And do you find that, where do you find that the limit is with in terms of recovery? I mean, from a Super Tri race, I understand that they can just get up and do a good volume day the next day, but if it's an Olympic distance race, is that also possible? Or at what point do you think that recovery after the race is maybe compromises the amount of training that you can do? Is it 7.3, or is it only after an Ironman that it really becomes hard to get in some decent volume almost immediately after the race?
This is very athlete specific, I think. So I have some athletes, and I think it also comes a bit to your morphology and muscle type. I think some athletes need, especially the fast twitch fiber guys, they need a bit of longer recovery time, in my opinion, experience. So I think some people are 3 days after Olympic distance, they can go, and some people need 10 days recovery, you know? So it's like, again, the years of training that you got, and I don't think you can say Olympic distance is this and that. You always have on the muscle level, you know, like we don't start hard intensity running, for example, 3 days later. No, we always take some time to recover from that. But volume wise with some athletes, I can go almost 3 days later after Olympic distance to normal volume, and some people need a week of recovery. So I think also the short thing sometimes, like the Super Tri for some people is really demanding, you know, and you see them like combined with the travel, you can see them coming back completely destroyed, and then you also say, okay, we need a few more easy days and then we start to work again. So it's hard to put a label on the race, you know, how much recovery you need for one race. It's always a bit of the the athlete morphology and their training background as well. How many years of training and how much volume do they have backed up already for years?
And do you take that into account in planning the races that the athlete is doing? If it's an athlete that tends to take longer to recover from races, then does that mean that they can't do as many races that are, let's say, not important because it takes away time from training too much? Or yes, do they have to be a bit more careful with putting in races in the calendar?
Yeah, I think that because they come to me with questions, hey, can I do this French Grand Prix or Bundesliga where they get some money? And like, and I say, look, this is where we need to go. This is your level now. And like, I think this will limit the amount of training you can do. And then we just say, okay, we're not doing this. And I try to give the bigger picture, you know, like to maybe you will win some money on the short term, but if you get your contract and on the long term, this will give you so much money more. And like, try to educate them in this and see, like, this is what you're training now. This is where I think we should go to. If you do these races, you have to do 4 days before, not training less, and then this, because there's all. And I think, yeah, that's a like really good communication with your athlete is super important in this. And then when they understand this, it's getting easier and easier to do that. And some people always try, you know, like, because, can I do this race and this race? And I'm like, I don't think it's a good idea. And in the end, it's their choice, you know, like if they really look forward to that race. But I also say, like, okay, but I think it's not the best program and we can still go for it if we, like, of course, sometimes there is something that I say, this is really not smart, like the thing that Martin did. I would never advise that to anybody else. So, yeah, I think you have to make good decisions and pick your battles. That's really important.
Yeah. And one thing that you mentioned there made me think that I'll add this question, which is not in our list of questions, but with the athlete profiling based on not, I don't mean like scientifically going into the mm-hmm. magnetic resonance scanner, but or doing a biopsy. But when you have the athletes that are more fast twitch profile versus slow twitch profile, and you just know it from their training and racing and things like that, how does that, is that something that you do you have some rules of thumb for how you maybe adapt training or other things for them differently? You already mentioned that the recovery might be one thing that is impacted, but are there other things that you think as can be said as rules of thumb for those categories of athletes?
Yeah, I think first of all, recognizing it is super important, huh? Like that you know it quickly in your build-up. Because, for example, when they do a long period of low intensity in winter and they don't include certain intensities, like they only get more glycolytic, which may be a bit contradictory, but it's something that you try to evaluate quickly, like what are we at? And like, especially in that early periods, we do like a lot of different specific key sessions. It's maybe not key sessions for some people, it's really easy, but like we differentiate a lot in the intensity there. And then like when you recognize it, we try to like always, we know this person is more fast switch, so we always try to do certain sessions, like always again, if he has a long racing block, maybe we see afterwards how much did he decline or not. Should we do some more low intensity and some faster work again? But I think like doing testing is super important actually, like to know, and you can also see it from power profiles, of course, and what you see on training and racing and evaluating races as well. I think yeah, there's not a real rule of thumb. It's like knowing what you're working with and like starting to work on it in time. I think that's the most important thing. Otherwise, if you let it go out of hand, it's really hard to correct in the season. So, and then they always keep on needing more recovery time. While you make them more aerobic, you can develop VO2, more volume. Their recovery will only get better and better over time. And that's what we see, for example, with some of these athletes, that they are gently doing more volume, and no, like it's still sometimes hard for them because they think, I can't train much, you know, like they're trying to see, like, hey, look, but this is where you were last year. We're already doing 2 hours a week more. We're getting closer. And because they're super hungry, they're super motivated. And yeah, it's just making them realize how they are built and try to guide them in that process.
So about the intensity specifically, what is the difference in intensity? I wasn't quite following what you were saying there with how the intensity might be different for the fast twitch guys.
Yeah, for example, what we did with some of these guys in winter is that we do some fast strides, two very short strides, not too long, also not too fast, just to activate those fast twitch fibers and then do a long tempo on it. That's something that we include quickly, but we never will do with somebody who is like really not anaerobic development. We just do some 6 times 30 second strides with a minute rest, you know, it's something like, this is one of the key things also, again, like doing a little bit of more depleted sessions with less carbs, because they're also doing less training volume, you know, like, and maybe a bit more like towards the tempo side from the beginning as well, to get that shift in the aerobic metabolism. Because I think it's super important to realize that your aerobic metabolism gets fuel from lactate and from the beta oxidation from your fat metabolism, and they're competing all the time, you know. So I think if these athletes are always like working at the wrong intensity, they're not developing the domain that they should be developing. And I think, yeah, that's something that you need to keep on doing, and it doesn't change like with doing 4 or 5 sessions, you know. Like, it's something that, like, over the entire year we try to keep on developing that system that we want to develop. So
yeah, so the principle there is basically what you mentioned earlier as well with the torque work, making the fast twitch fibers a bit more aerobic, making them work aerobically quite consistently for the fast twitch athletes, and the slow twitch guys might not need to do as much of that in the early part of the year anyway.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. Indeed. Yeah. Or right. Even like the VO2 max worker, it's something that you have to be watch out for, I think, because it's something that for these athletes is sometimes it's very natural to do, and they're very good in those 30, 15, 40, like, and but they completely go full lactic and like above VO2, you know, like, and it's also like, hey, look, I would prefer doing a third set, you know, but if you would go 20 watts lower and we have more time spent at VO2 max, for example, instead of even making your anaerobic or buffer capacity even stronger, you know. So I think that's something, yeah, like different as well for these athletes, you know.
Yeah. Then just briefly on Cassandre Bougrand, who is, as you said, joined your squad more recently after the Olympics. I'm curious here with the Olympic champion joining the squad, that must be quite a challenge, because there's not that much, I guess, that you can change with the Olympic champion in terms of improving her. So how do you view that challenge, and what do you think what are the things that you see that she can become even better at, and that you're working on developing with her?
Yeah, I think she did a very good job in the past, of course, now to is where she is now. And there's always things to improve, which is really important to, I think, also for her to realize. And we're trying to find these things now, gently, step by step, to see where we can improve. And it's been 6 months, and I think we found a few things already. It's maybe not big things, but it's also like making this plan of keeping her balanced. You know, I think after Olympics, we had a lot of talks about this, of like not pushing the program in the beginning, and finding balance between the things that come to her, like on the non-sport side of sponsors and things. And I think she also has to make kind of benefit of this now. But it's a tricky line, because if at one time your performance goes down, she starts to get unhappy as well. So we're finding the balance in that, and we picked some key things, I think, that were really good for her to races where she looked forward to doing. And that was, for example, the 5K in Monaco, which is something where I knew it would motivate her to try to beat the French record there, and that's, it's easy to work with her if she's motivated. And I think it was really cool to see her like perform there like the way she did. And things like that will be very important, I think, in the next period, to set these different goals as well. It was a 10K in my hometown Leuven in the European Championships, and I was thinking, would have been good to see Cassandre there as well, because I think she could have definitely do podium, and like if specific preparation, maybe more. I think things like that we still need to integrate to keep her performing, because I think I see that with other athletes who are a long time in WCS, maybe you've been around in the circuit so long that you get a bit bored of doing the same races again. And I want her to be having the same fire as for Paris in LA, I think. And we don't have to push her out now too much, I think, and just let her grow in certain things. I think the bike is something that we can still improve on. And I see some good, she was saying to me, I have to do this long distance training sometimes, like long rides and with LT1. Like, so it's not long distance training, you know, it's like also for your good in your profile now in this period. And I see some good shifts in the bike. And I think the bike skills as well is something that we need to keep working on. Like, it will be super important in the women's racing. And you saw in Paris what happened, you know, also with the ranges before the race. being prepared for every scenario is really important. And yeah, I think the science, she really likes it as well. But you also, again, like I said with Martin, it's sometimes knowing when you don't have to come with data and just let them train freely. Finding that balance, like I see with Pogacar and Van der Poel, is the same thing. No, they have good coaches with science teams behind them, but also sometimes they need to have their French fries or whatever, or go race a motor car. I think it's the same with Cassandra, that she has to have these moments as well, and then she's happy and she'll be motivated to train.
Yeah, no, that's a really, yeah, really good answer, really insightful. Speaking about cycling, this is another one out of the blue that's not on our sheet, but I'm, with your background in cycling, I'm sure you're following it closely. Is there something that you think is really interesting in the last few years in cycling, in terms of the training that maybe that you've brought into your cycling training in triathlon, or yeah, anything that stands out that you've kind of taken from cycling?
I'm not following it that much, actually, to be honest. And I think it's still a different world, you know, cycling. And I think maybe sometimes I even feel that cycling could learn more from triathlon in a way, like the multiple sessions and like what we do and how I see it. I think the bike level of these best athletes is in triathlon really good. They could be very good professional riders. Huh? I think they need to be able to have that extra punch at the moment where it's where it matters. Of course, this is something that's different in triathlon, where you don't win the race in cycling. I think in general, what I said more is about, you see this with the teams. I learned a lot from the planning of the altitude, you know, like and doing this, and the nutrition wise, how they work on this. It's harder with a triathlete, you know, like, because it's less completely exact, you know, with bike, with a power meter, you know, with so much calories. And which you go to, like, for example, they bike to the pool. Some people, it's 15 minutes to go to the pool. Like, everything, the energy availability is different, the recovery. Like, I think how much calories you exactly do in the pool. This is too much in triathlon, you know. You can't measure all this and the athlete will go crazy, I think. Like, so maybe you can do that a few weeks and just get more insight in your body. That could be useful, I think. But I think there's things we can learn from cycling, but also things we shouldn't incorporate in triathlon. And I think that's knowing the sport, and like, it's really two different sports in my opinion still. Well, there's very same basic principles, of course.
Fair enough. I want to come back as well a bit to the topic of technology, and specifically maybe AI. Is that something that you are using in some capacity, or are you following it? What are your expectations for the next few years with how that might impact the way that that coaches work, that athletes train, and so on?
Well, I think I'm a bit old school in that, and like I'm not using it yet, and I'm following it a bit, like, to see what's happening. But I think it's still very, like, in endurance sports, and especially then I think with the high level athletes, what I said earlier about working with the outliers, I think the systems need like a lot of data of like a broad population. And I think we're working a lot with those outliers who are responding different to things. So I think that's why maybe it's not so useful in my domain. And I think all the data you put in has to be correct. You know, I see so much incorrect data. Like, for example, a bike power meter, no? Like, I have sometimes a guy switching from road bike to TT bike, and the power meter is different, and there is already like a 15 watt difference. And you would make, say, oh, we made so much progress. And, you know, like, putting in it, and it, like, would be very good for you to say your theory was working. But it's so complex at the moment to have, if you can build a system with somebody like who's working close with you, and you can really communicate with that, I think then it could be interesting to have like this helicopter view on what you're doing. And then of course the big thing is those psychological factors, I think, that you like, that we see, like, as a coach, and to make decisions, I often do this to say like, okay, we're not doing these sessions because there's this big stressor here or there. And I feel self-reported stress could be something, of course, but I think an athlete sometimes says is doing good, you know, like if he would say mood in the morning, okay, and you can still see there's something going on. This is very hard to like, for the system, the AI, I think, to know what's happening in unless you go to, I don't know if you've seen the movie Her, and Alexa, who's calling in the morning with the athlete and asking how he's doing, and it get that smart that you like they can form some kind of algorithm to see if he's really doing good or not. No.
Yeah.
So I think it's still difficult in what we're working with, and there's for sure domains I think maybe like in bike position and aerodynamics where we could like speed things up when we go to testing to see this could benefit for this person more. And I'm always looking open-minded to see where it can be useful, so people can reach out as well if they think, hey, this could be useful for you and your athletes. So
yeah, no, that's a bit how I see it as well, that it's
okay,
there are a lot of different areas, different problems within the broader scope mm-hmm. of triathlon where you already have great solutions. But I do agree that with the you won't find your entire program based on the AI, there are a lot of limitations at the moment. And mm-hmm. I also don't see that a lot of those things won't change, like what you mentioned with the psychology. I find it hard to believe that somebody who is not, you know, a human coach mm-hmm. would think about what you said with like the motivation for Cassandra, for example, and realizing that we are working towards the French 5K record would be something that would be a good motivation, that sort of thing. But also what I see is what you said, the problem with clean data collection. There are some athletes are really good at it, some athletes are not so good at it. And if you're not good at it, then it's probably going to do a bit more harm than good almost. So there are definitely some limitations with that completely AI-based program that I think are hard to overcome.
Absolutely. We have actually a good example in Belgium. There was this runner who qualified for Olympics, John Hammonds. And he used AI to ask like, hey, which is the best races I should do to qualify based on the field. And like, and he followed that race and he qualified for Olympics. But then again, like, you know, somebody like Cassandra, you could say, this could be the best races for points wise and the field. And then you're that, like, that doesn't take into account that something like doing Monaco is super fun for her and motivates her. That doesn't make any sense to do that, maybe in a way in the system, you know, and this might make her perform way better in those races where it matters. So I think it's very hard to integrate it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'll definitely keep asking this question on different interviews because I think it leads to lots of discussions. And I think it's definitely already a part of, to some extent, a part of our world, whether we want it or not. So, and there are definitely areas where it can be useful, but it's figuring out what are those areas and how to use it well, and being aware of the limitations. I think those are some of the key questions that I'm thinking about, at least when it comes to how I integrate it personally. But let's move on to some reflective questions from your side. First of all, how do you learn and improve your craft?
Well, I read a lot. That's, I think, something like on all domains, actually, like it can be psychology, philosophy, like really on, I try to do that as a golden rule in my life to keep on reading. I have the luck, I think, to work with multiple federations. So they often send me articles or this or that, and we think this could be good or whatever, or with data analysis of like looking at race data to see like this is easy for me. It takes away some time of doing those analyses and it keeps me sharp, gives me different views as well. I have some very good colleagues. I had an old colleague who came to Girona a week ago, like to discuss some training principles, testing, you know, like, and super interesting conversations. I go to seminars online most of the time now because it's not easy to be somewhere else because I'm not much at home. And most important, if I'm interested in a topic, I always go back to scientific studies, you know, like, and I follow some Substacks. And if I'm like seeing things in training, I try to go read again more about lactate or whatever, and look at the quality of the studies. This is very important. I think this is something like now I see athletes, hey, we've seen this thing pop up and we should be doing this. And I say, look first at the population, like middle-aged women of whatever, you know, like it's like, or not athletes with a view to max of 80. I think it's something, if you don't have the scientific background, it's hard to filter, I think, what's very important, and also to know the quality of the studies. And there's a lot of bias as well in studies, I think. So I think it's trying to really dive into that, like with, like, how do you say it? Like to to be critical at all time what the study is saying and to see how you can integrate it in your work is really important, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And what is something that you're trying to learn more about at the moment or recently?
Well, I think the IRO effect is something that I feel. I really think you have to be specialized in this. And so I just want to be able to like grow with the athlete in that part because it's affecting your training a lot. And I feel like sometimes, like, I think we are not that advanced in that and it's hard to find. I want to speed up the process a bit, you know, like to see like how can we work with the best people and what do we should we be doing and when we go to an IRO testing, I think this and this and that. I think it's not my domain, to be honest, even though I come from cycling. I think it's became such, and I would like to learn a bit more even on that. Of course, I know the basics, and I just feel like it's very time consuming and to integrate it in your training, and you have to travel there and this and that. And I want to make that a bit more efficient now for the athletes, I think, and something that I would like to keep on working on now.
Yeah. This one is maybe a repeat. In addition to Anti-Fragile, do you have any other really good book that you would recommend that has been influential for you?
Well, I knew it would come, the question, so I couldn't answer that. Well, I wanted to answer something different, actually. It was a book that I was reading recently, and it's like really not related to triathlon or sports. And it was it's called In Lucia's Eyes from Arthur Japin. And it's actually about the perception of the woman who meets Don Quixote. Like, and I find it super interesting. The book is really well written. It's a beautiful book. I really recommend it. And it was a very good, like, the empathy side of being on the other side of... there's always two sides to a story, like, and also being successful in early life, and then she has some bad luck and her world changes completely, how she had to adapt with that and like develop her own skills on different domains. I think that's something that I also want to do with my athletes, you know, like I'm a good example of how quickly it can be over, and like your sports career, it can be in a blink, it can be over. I think I want to keep them educated and make sure there's more than triathlon in their world as well. And this book is very good in that, like, was very, and I sometimes give this little book to my athletes. It's called This Is Water. It's from David Foster Wallace, a very great novelist. And he gave it like a graduation speech about, liberal arts somewhere, I think, to the students. The speech, you can find it on YouTube as well, if you want, because some people, even reading a little book is hard, I think. So it's really great because it always says like, if you get irritated by something, by somebody who is going slow in traffic in front of you, maybe it's an old person who doesn't see good or whatever, you know, it's always putting yourself in that other position. And like and your world is very small. It's like two fish who are swimming together. It starts like that. And it says like, hey, how's the water today? And the other fish says, huh, what's water? You know, like you're very confined to what your world is. And I think you start to think that traveling is the very most important thing in the world. In our world, it isn't many times, but it's not in the world. And I want to still have that broader perspective with my athletes as well.
Yeah, great suggestions. And what is the best advice that you've ever received?
That was a hard one, to be honest. I just had to think about, I think many years ago in a Congress of Science and Sports from World Triathlon in Switzerland, saw Steven Seiler, and he said something about all the monitoring of the athletes, that the best thing is to head in bowls in the morning, like when you go to the breakfast table and you see the athletes hanging, like slumping, and the head is almost in the breakfast bowl. That's the time you have to back off with your training. And I think it's also like, this is a thing again about the AI. I think these body language things that you can see and perceive with your athletes, super important to not lose this feeling of paying attention to what's right direct in front of you, like, and all the data. Sometimes you just see what you have to see, and I think then trust your feeling that you have to do that, I think.
And if you could go back in time and give yourself some advice to yourself as a younger coach, that is, what would you say?
I think maybe I would have left Belgium earlier, I think. Like, I really find it as, like, if you get, like, a bit, like, limited by your environment, like the same for my athletes. I think it was very good to like meet many high level athletes in Girona, to work with other federations, I think, too, because I always thought I know only so little, there's so much more to know. And like, I still approach it this way. I think, of course, my knowledge has grown, but I think if you stop thinking that you know everything, it's everything ends there. So, and then the other advice that I would say is like to keep on setting limits, because your passion is your work, and you like get so absorbed in it that you also have to think about the little important things like family and friends, and it's hard to find that balance. And you also have to educate athletes, I think, like not WhatsApping you at night or like on a Sunday with a stupid question. I think it's something that they need to realize, and they are sometimes in their little world again, you know, like to realize as a person on the coach side as well. I think that's very important, and I want to be there for them always, but there's also some limitations and things that can wait sometimes, you know. That's important to set those limits.
Yeah. What is something when you left Belgium and you went to Spain, is there something that you remember that that you realized, or that something that you learned from getting that bigger perspective, working with different athletes, different federations, that you didn't have the ability to learn in Belgium, but that you learned when you moved out to that bigger environment, let's say?
Yeah, I think in Belgium we had this, in triathlon especially, like I think it was still the science of triathlon, like it was a lot of it, this physiologist Jan Olbrecht, I think, you know, you know him, of course, like which is really good. I love it's also the theory for insight and what these people are doing. But it was very like, it was almost treating the athletes as this lab-based thing, like with not even thinking about critical volume or whatever it's necessary, or like how to do many races in a year together. I think the theory was very developed on swimmers who have to do like certain like distance perfectly with the VLA max balance versus you. Doesn't matter if you get that number with doing 30 hours or 20 hours, you know. I think that does matter. That's my experience. And to keep developing on the long term. And that was something that I saw like in this high performance environments where there's always a critical volume, for example, why you would be almost ridiculized in Belgium if you were doing, oh, they're training so much, you know, like in this. Well, of course, the athletes, now you see those high performances, almost not anyone at the top, I think, who is not doing some kind of critical. Well, and it's different, like I said before, based on muscle type, whatever backgrounds, for every athlete. But yeah, I think that was something that really opened my eyes, how much some people train, and like that you also have to find borders, you know, and like not always be limited to the theories.
yeah no, that's a great point. Actually, on the volume, one thing that I'm curious about, I think there's a lot more information about the training of the top male athletes and a lot less of the top female athletes in your squad. Do the female athletes, do they, of course, it's individual differences, but are there gender differences in the volume, or on average, is it the same between the men and the women?
Well, in general, I would say it's definitely lower. Yeah? But I think, again, there are some women who can tolerate quite a lot of volume, but it's in general less than with the men, I think. And I think that's something like very hard to find that balance. And you need to, like I said, it's getting to know the athlete, you know, like with Cassandra, for example, this is a process where we're like seeing, okay, this is enough volume, you know, we could go higher, but I think this is enough. The quality is there now, and we don't want to, and we can still see later if we can get that volume up higher, higher and higher, because it might sound low towards what the guys are training, for example, but it's enough for her at this moment. And I had some girls in the past that like maybe like more diesels or in cycling who can do more, like also the impact of the running is also something, of course, very important. And in general, the girls run less. And it's something you can build over years, of course. And it's so multidimensional, you know, like with nutrition, everything needs to be balanced. And when you work for a long time with an athlete, you know, okay, we focus so much on how much carbs we have in a session, and you feel more safer to go up higher in volume, you know, if you have all these things right. You can go higher and higher, and I think that's where you need to work close together. So,
yeah. All right, yeah. Then I have a few listener questions. Sorry, I have to look down at my phone because, as I told you before, my printer wasn't working, so I don't have paper. But we have one question who is, when is Arnaud Delis making his Ironman debut?
Oh, man, like, I would actually really love to see. I'm really disappointed that he didn't have a good swim coach in his past, actually, because I always keep telling him your basic technique is really good, like, and he could have been a good triathlete, I think. And I think the day will come, but not yet in the near future. Like, we improved a lot on the bike, really. Like, that was his one of the main goals, like to keep the run, maybe improve it a little bit. And his bike is developing really strong. And I think he could be very good. And he has to become the new Lionel Sanders, maybe, or Sam Long, maybe is a better example, to try to catch as many people as possible. And yeah, one day it will come, I think, but not yet in the near future.
Then we have a question. How do you apply the Olbrecht training philosophy for WTCS and middle distance triathlon? We kind of talked about it a little bit, but maybe you can give a few more words on that.
Yeah, like I said, I think I want to keep the principles of what I learned back then and like what I saw with the people working with it. I think there's still very interesting things of it, but it's very limited in my opinion as well. So I think the basis, I work with it all the time, you know, the understanding of lactate glycolysis versus aerobic engine, like to really understand that it's, like it's super important where your threshold will be, like how it affects your, how much energy you spend. But then again, there's also some muscular demands which are not really in the system, I think. And again, the volume, I think, if you look at stroke volume as an example of that, to develop VO2 max. So I use it where I think it's useful, and I try to add the other things on top of it.
I should read out the names of the people asking. David asks, what resources do you use to stay on top of current new findings in exercise physiology?
Well, I think we answered that question earlier. I said like it's more, especially when I need something, I just go to PubMed or I reach out to physiologists. You know, like I had an interesting discussion with the people from Insight recently about some testing that I saw. And then it's really, I think that's, like I said, you have a good network now of people around you. And if you have questions, you just reach out to them and there's always something to learn.
Yeah. Tiago asks, why Girona?
Well, good question. Like, I actually really traveled all around Spain to find the perfect location. And I was thinking, Girona, there's already many people there. I don't want to go to Girona, maybe. But in the end, it's such a good place for, we have a 50 pool. We have so much diversity on the bike. We have a lot of off-road running. The airport is close by. We have Bagnoles Lake, and it's still one of the, in general, there was no place that could compete with all these factors. Like you're quickly out of town with a bike. Weather-wise, maybe there are a few places that are better, I think, in winter, but it's also maybe good to not be, like, you know, people from Australia in summer, they're always good in the beginning of the season, like, and they have an advantage there. But I think having the seasons in your life is also good to manage your energy, maybe. So, and definitely it was still very good weather there if you compare with Belgium or more up north where you come from. So even though maybe it's changing and in a few years we have to go to Belgium for with the squat, might be possible with climate change, no?
Let's see. What are the let's say number two and number three, if you looked at so many places in Spain, what would the other candidates have been?
Well, around Valencia was one of the candidates, I think, where there was some nice cycling around it as well and off-road running. But then like if you, the pool was more difficulty there, or 25 pool, if you go more to inside the town. I really like the Galicia, Pontevedra, that area as well. But then the weather is maybe a bit worse. The people there are very, because Catalans can be very stubborn. That's also something. Even I speak a bit of Spanish, but you still often have it that they don't like answering you in Spanish because they want to speak Catalan. I think like something that sometimes bothers me. But no, in general, I think it's still
in Galicia, Gallego.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, but I think they're like, if I speak Spanish, they're happy that you make the effort of making Spanish, you know, and they will respond in Spanish. So that's some, it's just a little thing, but there's some interesting places around the world, and maybe one day we will move, like, or Colombia, I don't know, something completely different at one point. We'll see where the road takes us, I think, and it also depends on the athletes you're working with and what they want, I think. So I'm open for many, I love Girona, like, it's still, like, I'm from Belgium, so we had a lot of culture, you know, like, and that's sometimes what I'm missing, like going to a good concert in the evening, like with some music, and now it's more a Catalan band playing or something that you like feel not the same level, and to have a bit more of that would be nice as well, to be honest.
Yeah. The final question is not a question. It's Leonard who is saying, just wishing good luck to my cousin. Say hi to him from me. So hi from Leonard.
Yeah, it's actually funny. It's like one of my little nephew who I babysitted on when I was young. And he was always a soccer player. And he's at one point, he reached out. He said, I'm going to do an Ironman. You want to coach me? I said, man, I don't have time like for this. And he did the Ironman. And I was very impressed that he did it. And I'm like, it's good to see like that you inspire people in your little network that you have from back home, that they're like doing these things and that they find so much joy in the sports. That's really beautiful to see.
Yeah, no, that's amazing. One of the great things about our sport. Thank you so much, Glenn. That's it. Finally, where can the listeners follow you and follow the squad?
Well, I said the website is not up to date, so definitely not there, I think. So I think PTC coaching on Instagram is thing where I try to keep things with stories updated and like how we work a bit, but also there I have to update the page a little bit, and like the demand is so high, I think, and like it takes time these things as well to do it. And I'm happy if we have a videographer or whatever with the squad following me, so I can just share something without having putting time in it. So I'm paying less and less attention to that, to be honest. And yeah, but still you can follow what we are doing there, where we are on the world, how we're training a bit. So I think that's the best way to follow us on Instagram. So
great. Well, I also want to wish you good luck for the rest of the season. It's already started, of course, but lots, a long way to go. So it will be exciting to follow the squad and the athletes, and hope to speak to you again another time.
Thank you very much, man. Thanks for the invitation, and good luck with your athletes as well.
Thank you. I hope that you enjoyed that interview. As always, you can find the show notes on scientifictriathlon.com with links to Glenn's website and Instagram. And as I mentioned, to his previous appearance on That Triathlon Show, which was back in episode 335 in 2022, April of 2022 specifically. Also, just a reminder that since a few months back, I am adding some new sections into the episode description, which is the part that you can see in your podcast app, whether you're listening on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or something else. Depending on the app, it might say details or description, what have you. But one of the new things that I put in there is a section called What Should I Listen To Next? So this is a great section if you haven't listened to every single episode that I've done since I started this podcast way back in 2017. Through this section, you will get some recommendations for episodes that are in some way similar, or that people that liked a particular episode will also like these new recommendations. They are evergreen episodes, of course, because most of the episodes that I do are evergreen, and they are episodes that, in my opinion, are very well worth listening to. So by checking that section after you finish a newly released episode, you can get some related episode recommendations that might be of interest to you if you enjoyed the episode that you were just listening to. So check that out if you're interested. And also, if you have requests for guests or topics that you want me to cover on the podcast, then remember that you can always contact me with feedback about the podcast, suggestions. I'm always happy to receive such things. So thank you in advance to everybody who's already been doing that. And yeah, I just wanted to put it out there for anybody who might not realize that I am receptive to feedback, that you can contact me via email. You can find it in the podcast episode description. And I'm looking forward to hearing from you. Now, what keeps the light on here is not the podcast, unfortunately. It doesn't pay many bills, although it pays for itself. But if you need help with training, that is how we make a living. So check out scientifictriathlon.com, where we have a number of products and services to help you take your performance to the next level, from ready-made training plans through one-off consultations to full individual coaching. If you are budget conscious, then a ready-made training plan is a fantastic option to go for. We've had hundreds of athletes, if not thousands by this point, set new PBs, qualify for world championships, or just successfully complete their first triathlon or their first Ironman or first 7.3 using these plans. They are very highly rated. You can see the ratings on Training Peaks, and we also have our own internal surveys that we use. So check them out. If you're budget conscious, this is by far the best way for you to get really good training without breaking the bank. That said, if you want to make sure that you tick all the boxes and you want help not just with your training, you want help with anything performance related, including tips on equipment, nutrition, race strategy, etc., and of course training that is dynamic and changes as life changes, then coaching is the way to go. And we have a handful of coaching slots available at the moment, so reach out if you're interested in that, and you can then have a discovery call with one of our coaches to learn more about how it works and whether it seems like a good fit to work together before you decide whether to sign up or not. The best time to get a coach is 10 years ago, maybe 20, but the second best time is today. So reach out if this interests you and we'll discuss more and see what options are best for you. Finally, big thanks to our sponsors, Precision Fuel and Hydration, that you can find on precisionfuelandhydration.com. If you're looking for high quality, practical and tasty fueling and hydration products, make sure to try Precision Fuel and Hydration. And don't forget to take 15% off your first order with the code TTS25. Thank you, as always, for listening. Keep training smart and keep loving triathlon.